From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tip-top Communist Party insiders are about to pick new leadership for China. It's a big deal. Meanwhile, China's superstar economy is sagging. We see Chinese workers rioting at a Foxconn plant. We see American workers out of work at home. My guest today, James McGregor, says there's a big problem now with Chinese state capitalism in China and in the USA. This hour on Point, we're looking under the hood of the Chinese juggernaut. Now, you can join the conversation. Is China still on a roll? Will it be undone by its own system? Will we? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Beijing is James McGregor, author, businessman, and longtime China watcher who's lived in the country for more than 20 years, a former reporter in China and Taiwan, former CEO of Dow Jones China, former chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. He's author of 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China. His new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. James McGregor, welcome. It's great to have you there.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Listen, there's so much that we want to learn from you today, but I hope I can just put some sound in front of you right here. This was the sound, James, of the big riot. This was about 8 or 9 days ago at Foxconn's Taiyuan manufacturing facility. This is in northern China. Some parts for iPhones and a lot more for American companies and others are made. The other riot shut down production for a day. 2,000 workers taking out their frustration. I'd love a little of your interpretation. Here's a little sound of the riot. Okay, James, just for starters, there's a lot we're going to look at here today, but do some interpretation. Americans saw that and thought, holy smokes, what is going on? I know it's just a little glimpse into a great big country, but put the pieces together for us. What did you see there? What's the puzzle it's part of?
Well, if you look at the big picture of the workers in China, they've been, for about 15 years, their wages were pretty stagnant, and a lot of the economy was built on their backs. And now the number of people at that age group from the countryside that go into work in the factories is shrinking very fast because of the one China policy.
One child policy.
Even if they're from poor areas, they've grown up with satellite TV where they see soap operas from Shanghai with wealthy people. So they want a middle class life. It's no longer the obedient worker. They want better life. They want better benefits. They want to be able to reach the middle class. And these people are, it's a younger generation, and it's a whole new world for China to deal with.
What's the case that you're making, James? China has seemed like it could do sort of no wrong. I mean, yes, you could make trade complaints, and yes, big environmental issues, and yes, it's been authoritarian. But just in terms of raw economic muscle, it's just gone up and up. Is there a reason that they should think that China will not be able to provide them a middle-class life at some point, whatever that means in China?
Well, we've just gone through the era of the American equivalent of the robber baron era and the Gilded Age in about 15 years, and there's been incredible wealth created. This place has changed so fast, and now people are looking and saying, well, the boom is over. What am I going to get out of this? And the good news is if they can empower these workers and they make them middle-class citizens and make them consumers, China can drive the world economy for another couple decades, but it means a huge shift. Because these workers are, they're all from the countryside, they move into the cities, they do not have urban license resident permits. So they, no schooling for their kids, no health care, no social benefits. So they're really second-class citizens. And right now, about 25% of the people in major cities in China fall into this status. So they have to build the new economy on their backs and make them full citizens and make them consumers. And that's a big shift, but These young people, they're not kowtowing to the government. They're demanding their rights.
Is the boom over in China? What's the evidence? What's the problem if it is?
Well, the boom has to change. It's what went on the last 30 years can't go on in the next 30 years. They're at a transition point where the economy has to change, and a lot of countries go through this. If you know, it's called the middle income trap, and it happens in countries where You have fast growth through exports and low-cost labor, and also by basically taking technology and know-how from the outside, adapting it, And then your exports drop off, your cost of your labor goes up, and you have to innovate. And what happens is it's really hard to make that second step to a high-income country because the people who made money in the first step, the vested interest, they don't want change because they don't want to lose out. Then the World Bank has a statistic of in 1960, there was 101 countries in that middle-income area. And by 1985, only 13 had broken through to high income. It's really, really hard to do, and that's where China's sitting right now.
Of course, it looked like they could do anything. They're still talking a good game. There's a huge leadership handoff coming there very soon. I've got a little tape here. I hope you'll listen with us, James McGregor. This is Xi Jinping. This is the expected successor to the Chinese President Hu Jintao. This is, 10 days ago, talking to the China ASEAN Expo. This is in Nanjing. And here's the guy who's expected to be at the top of the Communist Party, leading China very soon, talking about China's economic prospects. This was translated by CCTV, China's state-run television network. Listen to his optimism, confidence.
The current economic situation in China is generally sound. We have full confidence in our ability to speed up the shift of growth model, stabilize external demand, expand domestic demand, and build a society of higher level initial prosperity in an all-round way that benefits the over 1 billion people. China's development is peaceful, open, cooperative, and win-win oriented.
Xi Jinping, who is on track to be the next leader of China, and he says, James McGregor, no problem. We're everything's fine here. We have full confidence. It's good for us. It's good for everybody. What's your analysis?
Well, that's I think it's kind of it's campaign season in China in its own internal ways. I think it's kind of the audacity of hope here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got to speak positively about everything going forward. You know, the outgoing Premier Wen Jiabao, what he says about the Chinese economy is that it's unstable, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and unsustainable. And I'm not saying that one is right and the other is wrong. It's just Xi Jinping knows where this country has to go and the changes he has to make. The question is, will he have the political ability to do that? Because it's no more strongman leadership in China. The strongman leadership of whether Mao was Deng can take China in a really bad way or a good way in a quick period of time. So now it's a collective leadership, and it's either 7 or 9 people that are going to be on the standing committee at the top. And they all have their own vested interests. They've all got families. They've all got circles around them. And getting those people to line up behind what you need to do is going to be his problem. And he's walking into office with a huge pile of problems on his desk. So I think he's talking very optimistically because he needs to rally support.
In your new book, No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, you're pointing straight at what you say is the main culprit here. You call it authoritarian capitalism. You could call it state capitalism. You say it was tamped down a decade ago, but has come roaring back. Paint the picture of that. I think for a lot of Americans, it's hard to picture exactly what that is, its scale, what it is, what it means.
Yeah, let's go back to when the communists won here in 1949. They had 10,000 Russian advisors and 40,000 Chinese went and studied in Russia. And what they did is they built a centralized planned economy, state-owned economy. They kicked the Russians out in 1960, and ever since then, the Chinese have been trying to take that planned economy and fill it with Chinese characteristics and mix together Marx in the market ever since Deng Xiaoping took over. Deng Xiaoping empowered private enterprise to pull China out of the hole back in 79 when he took over. But in the last 10 years, they've really empowered state enterprise again. It's an ideological shift by the leadership. It's also the party preserving its own power because the party is able to use these state-owned enterprise not only to try to build the economy, but also to preserve the party's power. Where they need to move money. Where they need to move industry, they move industry. And that has worked pretty well. If you look at China and the infrastructure, and they've put $50 billion in redoing Beijing, Shanghai, other cities per city. The problem is it won't work anymore because these state-owned enterprises are fat and happy. They got monopolies. They don't add to growth. They don't add to job growth. And now they've got a lot of vested interests. A lot of people make a lot of money through those state-owned enterprise, But they are not what will drive the economy ahead. It's private enterprise or, you know, the entrepreneurs of China. They're going to have to unleash them again. And I think everybody's kind of clear that they have to do that. It's whether they have the ability to do it. And, you know, when Nixon came here 40 years ago, there was a lot of people in America thought, well, someday China will be more just like us. They will have more pluralistic politics, more of an open economy. And some of that has happened. But the fear is they become more just like us in big money politics and vested interests that prevent reforms and moving ahead in the way a lot of people know it needs to happen.
That looked like a pretty potent system for a lot of people in these last years. There's all these high-speed rail and got built and the cities got built up. It looked pretty jazzy. Some Americans were jealous of that central control.
Well, and also China, you know, what was a real turning point was the global financial crisis. China, you know, the leadership may not have liked our social or political system, but they admired Wall Street and our financial system. And then with the global financial crisis, then Wall Street was discredited and, you know, people on the left here who never liked Wall Street were saying, wait, the China model is superior. Our central planning with our banks and our state-owned enterprise, we've been able to get through the global financial crisis. And so we have a superior model. And, it worked. It worked. It got them where they are today, but it's not going to get them the next step.
James McGregor, please stand by there in Beijing. I'm sorry we have a break coming right up here. The new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Beijing's state capitalism and competing with China. My guest says the current setup is bad for China and bad for the world, U.S. included. We're looking from the Foxconn riots to how China is organized to jobs in the USA. My guest is James McGregor. His new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. And he knows of what he speaks, been in China for many years now, former CEO of Dow Jones China, reporter there in China and in Taiwan, former chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China. You know, Jim, as I recall, maybe a decade ago when China was looking to get into the World Trade Organization, you were a big booster saying, look, come on, we need them in there. And they've made changes that that will make them work in the global system. Is this new book a kind of mea culpa on your part? What happened here?
Well, I think that where China was headed in 2001 when they joined the World Trade Organization was a very different than where they went. China was, Zhu Rongji, the premier at the time, he'd laid off 50 million people, 50 million workers from state enterprise. They were empowering the private sector, and it was, you know, they didn't expect it to be a complete free market economy. It was moving much more towards that. And since then, they've just taken a U-turn and gone back with state enterprise and the party being in control of all enterprise. And when that has an interface with the world trade system, there's an incompatibility there because you can't, to file a trade case, you have to have legal discovery, you have to have independent judiciary, and you also have to have a government that's willing to play by the rules. And China will use the WTO when they want, but they'll go their own way with it. It's not really a mea culpa. I think China's just gone in a different direction. Now, that doesn't say I still would support China joining the WTO because I think it's brought them into the trade rules. Now we just got to make them go by the rules, or if the rules are going to be changed, they got to be changed in a way that works for everybody. Because right now, part of it is a WTO problem. The World Trade Organization is dysfunctional right now. It just can't get anything done. You know, the so-called Doha round where they have to modernize and go cross-border investment and intellectual property and a lot of other things. That's frozen too. So it's not only China. It's just the world trade system is pretty frozen right now in enforcing the rules.
Could you describe for us this really interesting blend of state capitalism, authoritarian capitalism, as you call it, and more entrepreneurial capitalism in China? State-owned enterprises, what portion of the economy do they make up? What kind of industries? And how does their ownership, how do the roots of it go into the Communist Party hierarchy?
Yeah, it's very interesting because in the old days when the state-owned enterprises used to report to the various ministries, so like the Ministry of Agriculture would have all these food enterprises and, you know, transportation, et cetera, under that. Well, what they did is they corporatized them and they had shares. And then the majority of the shares, or all the shares in some cases, went into this group called the State Assets Commission. And they're supposed to be the majority shareholder in carrying the government's shares. Well, that's all well and good. They corporatized. But what's happened is then the party itself appoints the top leadership of all these big SOEs, these big state-owned enterprise. And so, and these people are minister or vice minister level. One day you're the head of China Mobile. The next day you may be the governor of Shaanxi province. They move them back and forth. So they're political actors. So the power goes right into the party, more than the government, really. And that's I think, the core of what I call authoritarian capitalism. The party's able to manipulate these businesses in the way they want. Meanwhile, private enterprise here, and there's a lot of people who have made a lot of money and done very well, but they can't get credit. They're living off loan sharks, basically, because they can't get money from the state banks, and they were knocked out of about two dozen sectors with a rule that came out in 2006, and so they're disheartened. A lot of the wealthy private entrepreneurs are applying for green cards in the United States. They don't want to leave here for good, but they want to get a foot offshore because they're worried about the system. The good news in China is this is a very entrepreneurial country. All the government has to do is, with a wink and a nod, say, go for it, and give these private entrepreneurs a room to run, and they'll kind of run away with it.
So the businesses, the industries you're talking about, were telecom, energy, banking, steel, very large ones. What portion of the economy in those state capitalist hands that often go back to party leadership?
Somewhere between 40% and 50% of the economy is controlled by state enterprise. But, you know, let me clarify. State-owned enterprise, there's about 115,000 of them in China. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about a little over 100 of the big central ones, because a lot of those other ones are really fairly private companies that had to park themselves under a government unit back in the day when it wasn't kosher to be a capitalist here. So some of those are okay, but it's the big central behemoths that they just control way too much. And they're in all the heavy industry and technology sectors is where they have the control.
Are China's leaders talking now about whether the state-owned sector has grown too large? And if they are, how does that factor into the choice of the next leadership coming right up? I mean, the big meeting coming up in November, they're about to have a transition. If they're making a lot of money off these companies, party members, their families, they must want to know what's coming policy-wise here, if they're going to loosen up that state control or not. They've got a lot at stake.
Well, I think that's what's going on now behind closed doors. There's a lot of maneuvering and a lot of negotiating because people, you know, it's funny, but China is a country now that has to forgive original sin in some sense, because a lot of people have made a lot of money through a lot of corrupt ways here. But in fact, it was almost hard to make money in a completely honest way because the government's involved in every transaction. So the people that made money under those conditions, they got to kind of say, okay, you made your money, now stop and move on, and you got to let go of your grip. And, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, but that's kind of what they have to do. But, you know, there's a lot of families that have made a lot of money, because what happens is these big state-owned enterprises, they list their shares in Hong Kong or Singapore, or even the United States. And then family members get on the boards, they get shares, they can get, some of them have hundreds of millions of dollars or dozens of millions of dollars. And, you know, it's hard to give that up. So there's a behind the scenes. And how does this play into the leadership? It makes, you know, Romney or Obama, for all the problems America has, they've got a tough job, whoever wins that election. But I tell you, it's nothing compared to the next leader of China and the job this person has to do, because they have to switch the economic model of this country or they'll be the one that killed the Chinese economic miracle. And, you know, it's not going to be an easy thing to do. It's still a fairly feudal political system.
You've described some Chinese in the party, even, I think, saying they kind of envy the American way. As messy as it can be, we have a way of changing periodically. They've always got that same kind of inside high leadership of the Communist Party in charge.
Yeah, well, when nobody had anything here, everybody was for reform, because they could get something out of it. But now there's a lot of people that have something that don't want change because they're threatened by change. And the, you know, the U.S., there's a narrative here since the global financial crisis in a lot of the official press that America is a failed country and it is now, it's heading down and it's not going to recover. And I think there's, you know, a lot of people in the government believe that, but not at the top that know the way the world works. They use that propaganda for their own people, but internally they don't believe that. They know that their system is not as flexible as ours. And, you know, we don't seem to be solving our problems. And I think it's taking a lot longer this time because of the way our politics are. But we have a way of doing it where they don't. They don't. You know, they were able to make changes before and get to the system they have now. But to make the next change, it's not built into the system.
James McGregor joins us from Beijing. His new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers. Got a lot of callers for you, James. Sean's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Sean, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to see if Mr. McGregor could talk a little bit about any parallels he might see between the Soviet Union and their, you know, reluctance to shift from a state socialism or a state capitalism, and, you know, compare it to, I guess, what's going on in China today. And I don't know if he thought about that in any way, but I guess I was curious to see if there is any connections between the two.
Yeah, Sean, thank you for your call. James, you're right that they were paying a lot of attention to what happened in Russia after the breakup of the Soviet Union. What's the link?
Yeah, you know, they learned their system from the Soviets, right? And then when the Soviet Union broke up, they watched how the state assets, the valuable state assets in Russia, were handed over to oligarchs, were handed over to people connected to the KGB or other people politically connected. So the wealth of the state, whether it's oil or minerals or whatever, ended up in the hands of private individuals who became multi-billionaires. China watched this happening, the party watched this happening, and they also saw some of this happening on a small scale out in their provincial state-owned enterprise. So they said, and this is, you know, this is a positive. They said, well, we can't have that. So they said, we're going to bring it into the party. So the party became the oligarchy here. And that's part of moving all these state assets into control by this asset commission and ultimately the party. So that was a good start. But now it's kind of run off at its own with individuals in the party enriching themselves through these state assets. So they learned from the Russians and they took a different tack on it. And you know, if they're able to turn this around and get it right, I think history will show they made a pretty good move compared to the Russians. Because, you know, look at Russia. You got billionaires buying up buildings in New York, but much of the country is not doing very well. And if they didn't have natural resources, they'd be doing horribly.
I want to ask about how all these decisions inside China affect the rest of the world and the United States. I'm reading you here saying, James McGregor saying, I see China going in a direction that the West didn't think China was going in. I see growing antagonism, you're saying here, that's going to lead to conflict between the U.S. and China and others. And I see nobody speaking honestly because everybody's scared of China. What's the problem?
Well, you know, China, you know, the system here is, you know, it's not tolerated to speak out against the government. And they've applied that internationally. So multinationals that have troubles here, unless they have no hope and no recourse, that's when they actually talk to the foreign press and you'll see something in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times. But the retribution here is very strong for anybody that complains about the system. And you know, that then goes into the World Trade Organization where they intimidate companies from filing cases, they intimidate countries from filing cases, and in the end it's not in their best interest because I've watched the goodwill of the foreign business community kind of melt away here. You know, you got to remember, China was on its back when they opened up, and I've seen foreign companies and foreign governments come in here and with a lot of know-how, a lot of training and, you know, legal systems. And also, you know, the U.S. opened up its market to Chinese goods and, you know, a lot of the economy here was built on the American
Sure.
market. But the rhetoric now is the foreigners are out to get us.
So what are the problems? You've described some of the problems for China's own economy internally, which has been slowing markedly recently, of all this state capitalist sector, very big sector. What problems does it create for the rest of the world, USA included?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about is technology. What, you know, China has been playing technology catch up with the West for going back to the Mao days, And the bargain was when China opened its markets, it would trade technology for market share. So you bring in your technology, you're going to get some market share out of it. But then a lot of the companies here were finding that their technology was being stolen and copied. And so they became very reluctant and protective. So China, you know, in 2006 said, well, look, we're, you know, the foreign companies aren't sharing technology. And they ordered their companies. They came up with this program called Indigenous Innovation, which when it came out of the top leadership, it was well-intentioned to improve their ability to invent and improve their science establishment. But once it got into the bureaucrats, it became a money game. And the, you know, the explicit rules that were written out were you must, you know, foreign companies in certain sectors come in here and they've got to partner with the Chinese state-owned enterprise. And then that enterprise is supposed to co-innovate, re-innovate, assimilate, and master that technology, and then become a national champion and go out on their own. So it's, you know, whether it's General Electric or United Technologies or Microsoft or Intel, these companies now are very worried about their technology being stolen here, and they know the people that they have to partner with are under orders to learn their technology and beat them overseas. So the Chinese would call that a Mao Dun, a very strong contradiction.
Well, where are we in this relationship? You know how bad the growth has been in the U.S. economy. You know how bad unemployment has been here. And people can sometimes feel that we're in a game we cannot win with China. How do you see it?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons I wrote this book is I just wanted to get the facts out on the table because Washington, the politicians in Washington grabbed the currency issue, and that became the end-all and be-all, and that's all they talked about. And the currency issue, in fact, it's not really an issue anymore, and it was for a while, but it was just one small slice of a wide array of industrial policies. So as the more Washington talked about the currency, the more these complicated, difficult policies that are hard to explain that China was able to get away with. And so it's we just have to lay the facts on the table. We have to protect our businesses because the businesses, they're really stuck because for many of them, China's the growth market. At the same time, they're facing these difficulties. So it's, you know, damned if you do and damned if you don't. So it's up to the government and the trade associations and the politicians to get an honest conversation going because China is the biggest benefactor of the world trade system as it stands. It does them no good for it to fall apart. And you just got to start you got to push back.
Push back. Do you expect that to happen in trade negotiations? What arena would you like to see that show up in?
Well, it should happen in the bilateral negotiations we have between the U.S. and China. We have them with the Treasury Department. We have them with the Commerce Department. We have them with the White House. You know, there's the strategic and economic dialogue once a year, and there's the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, which are two different things. But those bodies are important. They meet, but they're discussing nonsense. They are not discussing the main issues. They get, you know, one of the differences is we're very tied up in process. Our you know, we're a country of laws and legal systems and process. So we're very tied up in the step-by-step process of all these negotiations and the rules and moving along. China's about income. About outcome. And so they will go along and with the rules when they work for them. When they don't, they'll just kind of obfuscate and mosey along because they're focused on the outcome of what they need. And we just kind of got to get on the same page of because, you know, if you look at U.S. and China, we do not have any real deep economic conflicts. Both these countries are fairly complementary in what they need. Right now, the U.S. needs Chinese capital. Before, China needed U.S. capital.
We'll come back and look at exactly
more Chinese investment in the U.S., the better.
We'll come back and look at exactly how that ought to work. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Beijing's state capitalism and competing with China. My guest is James McGregor. His new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. Former reporter in Taiwan, in China, former CEO of Dow Jones China, chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in China at one time. He's now out with a new, pretty critical take on what's going on. Says the Chinese themselves know it's a problem, but there are lines of interest here that go right into the heart of the Chinese Communist Party, which gets us to the whole change of leadership coming up and the whole ball of wax with the U.S. Joins us from Beijing, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Beijing last month. Here she was on September 5th saying that the United States is not aiming to contain China.
The United States welcomes a strong, stable, prosperous China that plays a role in world affairs commensurate with its size and helps to maintain and shape the global order. And we believe strongly that China has a vital role as a force for security and peace, stability and prosperity regionally and globally.
There's the positive nudge from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Here was a different tone. This was in one of the GOP debates last November, Spartanburg, South Carolina. Moderator Scott Pelley of CBS News asked candidate Mitt Romney how he would deal with trade with China if he were elected president.
Well, number one on day one is acknowledging something which everyone knows. They're a currency manipulator. And on that basis, we also go before the WTO and bring an action against them as a currency manipulator. And that allows us to apply selectively tariffs where we believe they are stealing our intellectual property, hacking into our computers, or artificially lowering their prices and killing American jobs.
Mitt Romney on the campaign trail. James McGregor in Beijing, what about that? If it should be President Romney and we go that way on day one, tag them, call them a currency manipulator, and then go for tariffs. Is that the answer?
Well, to be truthful, that's nice campaign rhetoric, but it means nothing because it doesn't fit into any really policy structure. He can call him a currency manipulator, but what does it mean? And it's not the main issue, but he knows that is the issue that everybody's aware of, and then he's playing off into the other issues. I think Romney's talking about taking a tough stance on trade. And Obama's taking a much tougher stance on trade with China right now. So I really don't think they're that far apart. And this happens in every election. The challenger always accuses the incumbent of being weak on China. They get into the White House. They sit in the Oval Office and they look around. And their policy ends up to be pretty much the same. And really, I think both parties now are looking at getting tougher on China, and that's probably a good thing as long as it's rational, it's fair, and they go after the issues that matter in a smart way, and you know the currency is a nonsense issue right now. They've floated their currency by 20%. There's much more important issues.
We'll look at what getting tougher might productively mean here. Let's get our callers in. Heather in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Heather, you're on the air with James in Beijing.
Hi, Tom. This is very small potatoes, but as a visitor to China, I've never been able to understand or to perceive the interpenetration of state capitalism with what is happening on the street. I've never been able to tell when I'm walking down the street what I am looking at in terms of enterprise and supply chains and who owns what and where the state applies its heavier hand. And it actually matters a bit because it has a lot to do with the way people in China feel about what's happening to them. And I'm just looking for help, and I'll gladly take a comment off the air.
Heather, that's great. James, walk us through, I don't know, down a block or around a few blocks. How do you perceive what's state-owned and what's not? How does it present in the Chinese economy?
Okay, well, let's just walk down the street. You'll pass Bank of China or Agriculture Bank of China or Construction Bank of China. And these are the big state-owned banks that are basically the financial system of the country. They make loans based on mostly government edicts and to state enterprise. They don't get to the private sector. However, you go around the corner and there are a whole string of shops, and these are all private shops, and these people are doing fine. It's a very mixed let's say it's pretty murky on what's state-owned and what's not, and even what is nominally called state-owned. They're called Red Hat Enterprises, Hong Maozi, and what it means is this is a private company that parked itself under a government entity years ago to protect themselves. That government may nominally still own it, but it's run like a private company, and the government takes a piece of the money. There's a lot of companies like that. It comes in all shades and colors and forms. And most of it works pretty well, except for these big central monopolies. They're the ones that are really kind of choking things off right now, and they're the ones that need to be reformed.
Do Chinese people, businessmen know? Do they always know or sometimes know if it's state or not? Does it matter if you're in the system?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you look at really one of the things we're seeing now is red-collar workers. The multinationals are unable to meet the same pay standards now as these big state-owned enterprises because they have monopolies and they're paying so much. So these kids coming out of college are going into the state enterprises these days. So, people know, and private entrepreneurs know because they're blocking them from getting into certain sectors. And I was at a lunch about 3 months ago, and around the table were probably 10 people who were pretty senior guys in big state-owned enterprise. The conversation at the lunch table was state-owned enterprise is too big, it's choking the economy, and it needs to change. And these are the guys that are in the middle of it because they see how inefficient it is. And they've got kids who need jobs, and they know this economy needs to grow.
Red-collar workers, there's a new one. 800-423-8255. Ed is calling from Quebec, Canada. Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to ask you, Mr. McGregor, in view of all this China bashing on the campaign trail, it seems to me that it's counterproductive because the Chinese are funding the domestic deficit in the U.S., and I was wondering, how does he see it, or how is it perceived in over there in Beijing?
James.
Yeah, we have a lot. We have a lot to answer for ourselves, because we've let our system slip so much that we have all these ideological battles over tax and spend, and the result is that we have this huge deficit, and the Chinese are the ones that are filling it. So how strong can Obama or Hillary or, whether it's Romney or somebody else when they come over here, how strong can they be in discussing other issues if they're talking to the banker? And if that banker sits out a treasury auction, it could, send the U.S. commodity and stock markets reeling. So a lot of our damage with China and a lot of our weakened position with China is of our own doing. If we get it together, that's important, and China's got nothing to do with that. That's our own system and our own discipline.
And yet, you describe again and again situations in which the U.S. ends up a loser on the losing end of this Chinese structure. We've seen solar, for example, manufacturing go to China. You say China violates international restrictions on subsidies by hiding the funds where investigators can't find them, and this state capitalism is a part of that.
Yes, and that's another reason why I wrote this, because people in special, the specialists, and you have specialists in trade, you got specialists in technology, you got specialists in heavy industry and steel, etc. But nobody crosses all of those disciplines and takes a real in-depth look at the big picture. And that's what myself and my researchers tried to do, to just kind of connect the dots. Because if you connect the dots and you tell the story, it makes it much more clear of how it flows together. And hopefully from that, there can be some solutions that are really both for China and the U.S. And I tell you, a lot of the sources in this book are Chinese. It's from Chinese government reports. The World Bank and the State Council, which is China's cabinet, their think tank did a report early this year that 450 pages, and if you read through it, it's chapter and verse of the reforms they need to make, and a lot of those are what I outline in the book. It's just this stuff goes on somebody's shelf and nobody pays attention to it unless it gets into the political system in an understandable way, and that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to make the conversation more relevant.
So as we understand it better, as it's more relevant, how should the U.S. get tough in a way that matters here? I mean, you describe systems so different. Their legal structure, for example, you say their judges are Chinese appointed. They lack the authority to compel evidence gathering, so it's almost impossible for foreign companies even to build a trade case. How do you deal with a situation like that, multiplied by how many companies?
Well, that's why they pay big money to the guys in Washington. They got to figure that out. But I think part of it is just basically acknowledging that their system and our system are facing very serious incompatibilities. And the longer that we talk past each other about issues that don't matter, it's just going to get worse and worse, and then that's going to lead to some kind of a trade conflict or you know, that's not going to be good for anybody. I mean, the simple matter is we have global rules on how these things work, and we need to start enforcing those rules on China. And if China has the power and the imperative to change some of the rules, let them do so, because, you know, they're a rising power, and if they see things a different way, let them step forward and say, okay, we need to change these rules, not just play games and violate the ones that are already on the books.
Where does the leverage come from for the U.S. in that conversation?
Well, the leverage comes from that, you know, China needs foreign investment still. China needs other people's markets. China's right now, you know, the U.S. is kind of, I think the U.S. is at the stage where we're getting towards, we're finally going to start fixing our problems. I think we've kind of run out of options. Where China's coming off this, you know, this long time role, and they're just going to start facing this. So they need to keep things going too. Remember, this is an authoritarian government, but it's an authoritarian government that runs scared of its own citizens in many ways, because if you threaten the power of the party, you're in big trouble here. But generally, the young people here, if you're under 40 years old, you've grown up in a China where all you know is exponential growth. All you know is 10% growth a year. They haven't suffered. They're kind of I was born in the 50s. They're like the post-World War II generation that went through the American boom. And they have high expectations, and the party's only credibility here is making life better. People can't speak out. They don't have all the electoral mechanisms. So the party has to provide a better life, or people are not going to put up with it.
So fall off that 8 or 9% growth, and they may be in trouble. James McGregor joins us from Beijing. His new book is No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers. James, here's a question online from Ray in Vermont. He says, what's the impact of rising Chinese wages? There were reports a couple of years back of firms shuttering factories in China, shipping jobs to Vietnam because they'd work for less than the Chinese were now expecting. What about wages and the Chinese economy?
Yes. That's a very important issue, because the worker wages were held down here for a long time, but not anymore. The workers now have a lot of rights, and they're more demanding. And we're looking at 20% increases a year in factory wages, and that is more so than even moving to Vietnam. I think some of the high-end manufacturing is moving back to the U.S. They're calling it reshoring, because you know the technology involved in manufacturing is changing. We're now getting these where you basically print out parts. That's the cutting edge, and that's where things are going. And the trouble of communicating with people in different time zones across the ocean, the cost of shipping. There's some of these jobs are moving back to the U.S. And with the rising wages here, it's not so cheap anymore. So they do have productivity gains, because they used to throw labor at things instead of technology and robots, etc. And China's going to move into that, but. Yeah, it's a big thing, and it's balancing out for U.S. manufacturing jobs. I think the U.S. manufacturing is gonna see a bit of a recovery, both through innovation and technology. I mean, that's our great strength, is innovation and technology. And if I can put one pitch in here, it's immigration. Let the brains of the world come to America. You know what we do now? We have all the brains of the world come and study in our universities. They get scholarships, and then we say, go home. We say, all right, good for you, now go home. That's a crazy policy. Let these people stay, because they refresh the country. We have the system that they can never do that here. You know, Steve Jobs hasn't emerged in China and is not going to emerge in China. Let's keep the brains of the world in the U.S.
James, a listener on Facebook asks, looking at the slowdown and the environmental toll that China's growth has taken in recent years, says, is it a bad thing to maybe slow down a little and not pave over everything in China? I guess he's asking, what about the consequences of slowdown there? The implications.
Yeah, you know, he's right. What's really remarkable, I had dinner with some friends, Chinese friends last night, and I knew them when they had nothing, and they're doing very well now. They got you know, nice cars and apartments, and they travel, and they're unhappy. You would have thought with all this progress in China that people would be giddy, and they're unhappy. And why? Because life has gotten a lot more difficult in that pollution is really, really terrible in the major cities. Traffic is terrible. People are stressed out. They're working all the time. Their health, you know, people's health is deteriorating. It's a tough, stressful life now. And that's, you know, quality of life for them. They got nicer cars and, you know, they have cars and they've got a better life, but the quality of life has been slipping. And that's, people are feeling that. And pollution is a very serious issue. Food poisoning, you know, meaning that there's poisons put in the food and chemicals and bad food products. I don't know anybody who's got money here who has a baby who doesn't import their milk powder because they don't trust the Chinese milk powder because it's been tainted with so many chemicals to fake the protein level.
We've just got half a minute here. The justification has always been we have to have great growth for political stability. If it should slow down and stay down a bit, what about stability?
Well, you know, in China, a place like China, you've got this balance between repression and reward, repression and opportunity. And the repression's gone up in the last decade, and they need to move the opportunity up. And you give Chinese people an opportunity, they're going to run away with it.
James McGregor, author of No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism. What the saying is from Tang Dynasty, what when you're losing your way in uncharted territory, is that really where China is now?
Yes, yeah, and doing something no one else has done before. It's a very unique system heading off in uncharted territory, and you know, that's where they're headed, and I got that, you know, that's a quote from a very senior economic planner here who cited that poem.
Well, thanks for focusing us today, James McGregor in Beijing. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.